The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So it's the custom here at IMC for the first talk that I give every the first Sunday talk I give every year, and the first Monday talk, to give it on the Four Noble Truths. And so I'll do that today. And the reason for that is that the Four Noble Truths lay at the foundation, at the pinnacle, and all the way through in between in Buddhism, in Buddhist practice. That in some sense, all of Buddhist practice is an expansion on these core teachings, the Four Noble Truths. And so here we begin a new year. I thought it's nice to start the new year emphasizing the importance of this. And perhaps as the year goes along, you can refer back to the teachings of the Four Noble Truths. I think of the Four Noble Truths as certainly a precious jewel that Buddhism maintains and supports and teaches. I also think of it as a protection, that by referring to them or practicing with them, that these four truths really protect oneself from one's practice, protect oneself from oneself, protects oneself and one's life as one goes along. The very, very useful reference point to constantly come back to and refer to. They can be applied in many different ways. And there's one teacher who defines the first noble truth, the truth, usually in English it's called the truth of suffering. He defines it not by suffering, but by the truth of stress. Because stress is a much more broad kind of term than suffering. And then you find it can be very easily applied to stress reduction. Just, you know, very simple. You know, you're tense at the traffic light, it's turned red. And so you want to kind of deal with that tension. So you notice that the tension comes from your desire to get somewhere fast. And so to reduce your stress, you reduce that, you kind of soften and let go of that desire. So you can sit there, maybe just watch your breath as you're waiting for the light to turn green. Pretty small and innocent. It's not very religious, but it's an application of the Four Noble Truths. And then the Four Noble Truths apply to the deepest teachings Buddhism has to do, or the deepest pointing to the human psyche or the heart that Buddhism points to, the possibility of the human heart to uproot the deepest places of suffering, the deepest places of clinging, and find the heart really freed, opened up, transparent, luminously empty of suffering and clinging. Many years ago, when I was in my early 20s, I went to see an old girlfriend who by that time was going to medical school, and we went to have dinner at her house with her roommates. And perhaps I was a little bit intimidated by all these medical students, smart people and all that. But anyway, she asked me at dinner, since I was involved by that time in Buddhism, she asked me, you know, what was the, you know, essential teaching of Buddhism? Why was I interested? And I recited to her the Four Noble Truths, and probably did it a little bit kind of from memory rather than from real understanding, but I referred to it. And I remember leaving that dinner and walking through San Francisco and kind of feeling, oh, you know, that was kind of embarrassing. Here I was involved with one of the world's great religions, and all I had to say about it was the Four Noble Truths. And many years later, I remember remembering back on that kind of reflection I had about being embarrassed by talking about the Four Noble Truths. And maybe I should have been embarrassed because I didn't probably really understand them. But there's no need to see the Four Noble Truths as being kind of a grade school Buddhism. Or it might be easy to explicate or to describe. But to really apply it to one's life is really a powerful thing to do. The word noble is interesting, noble truths. There's one Pali scholar who's very, you know, fluent in the language of Pali and scholar for a long time. And he translates it not as the Four Noble Truths, but the Four Ennobling Truths. And because these are truths that have to, that are supposed to transform us or change us. And they change us into people that are upright, of dignity, in the ancient language, kind of nobility, noble. And so these are the insights, these are the understanding that allow that transformation to happen. So the Four Ennobling Truths. There is another way that our tradition understands the word, because the Pali word, the grammar of it, is a little bit ambiguous, or it's multivalent. So how you translate the term into English, you actually have to translate it three or four different ways to get all the different original meanings of how that term is. And noble truth is just one possibility. But the preferred way in the tradition would be to translate it as the truths of the noble ones. So so these are the people who have had some kind of profound transformation of the heart, profound transformation that allows them to really free their hearts, their minds of clinging, of grasping, of fear, of distress, of ambition and greed, that they would see the world in a new way. They have insight. And that insight, that seeing the world in a new way, is said to be seeing through the perspective of these four truths. So this is how an enlightened person would see things. Not anything at all. I mean, they see lots of things to see, right? But how they see the essence, the essential aspect of what in Buddhism we can call the spiritual life, that it's understood this way. It begins with this called the truth of dukkha. And dukkha is more, as I said, often translated into English as suffering. But suffering is kind of a somewhat vague word or general word, and doesn't really do justice to the Pali word, the Indian word dukkha. And probably no single word would. Some people prefer just to keep it in Pali, and so that we can get a sense of all the different aspects of it. But certainly stress is one term for it. The opposite of it is sukha. And sukha also has a number of different meanings. The prefix du means kind of like bad in Pali, and the su means good. So there's kind of the contrast. But sukha is often translated as happiness, but also often translated as ease. Whatever the opposite of ease and happiness is dukkha. So maybe sometimes it's stress, sometimes it's maybe suffering, distress. I think a very interesting word to think of as the first noble truth, the dukkha, is the word conflict. And I would like to use the word conflict today maybe as the way of kind of entry into the Four Noble Truths. Now, Buddhism doesn't rely on the authority of gods or a god to tell you what you should do. So in terms of finding what's meaningful for your life and what's an important way to live your life, Buddhism doesn't have some authoritative book upon which says, this is what it means to be a human being and this is what you should do. And to be a fulfilled human being, you should do these things. And if you don't rely on tradition or external deities or on, Bibles or something to tell you this is what it should be doing, then what do you use as a criteria for finding your way, to find out what is a fulfilled human life, what's a meaningful human life to be had? Back in the ancient Greek times, the Greeks, some of the Greeks, philosophers who also were grappling with this very question, used something as it was very experiential, immediate in this lifetime, as a reference point for understanding what was a fulfilled or satisfying or meaningful life. And they used some people have translated as happiness, others as the capacity to thrive, human thriving, but the capacity to be happy. And many quests or pursuits that people have in their life, if you look underneath why a person's doing it, or is to some sense of happiness or well-being that they're trying to experience. And And somehow that reference point or the measurement of well-being or happiness or thriving in this lifetime, here and now, is one of the fundamentally important and maybe only criteria you can use for understanding what is a meaningful life, if you don't rely on these kind of external sources of authority, manuals that tell you this is thou shalt do this. You'll be fulfilled in the next lifetime if you do this or whatever. And it seems a little bit odd to some people to hear that happiness or well-being can be a reference point for a meaningful life, because isn't that selfish? Isn't a meaningful life have to do with self-sacrifice? And that's part of the message that's been given by some religious traditions, that to live a meaningful life you have to do a lot of self-sacrifice, and then that's what's meaningful. But the idea that to be happy is selfish runs as a current through, I think, some of Western culture. But what else could there be if you don't have these external authorities? Certainly you're not going to say that the more suffering the better. You know, if I can, you know, whoever accumulates the most suffering by the time you die wins. That doesn't work. One of the biggest challenges, though, to suffering as a reference point for a meaningful life would be the suffering of others, and the idea of you should be compassionate and supportive of other people and help other people. But how do you know what's supportive and helpful for them? What's the measurement for that? It's their happiness and well-being and welfare, right? And so still that becomes the reference point for understanding how to what to do in our life. So there has to be some understanding of well-being or happiness. And so in order to kind of move towards that, you have to understand something about happiness or well-being, what provides welfare for you. And you have to know something about the opposite of that. You have to know something about that which is the opposite of happiness. So in a kind of a simplistic way, Buddhism uses the word dukkha to represent that. And so the first noble truth is a truth of suffering. It does not say that life is suffering, which is often a modern kind of popular way of talking about the first noble truth. Because if the Buddha had said life is suffering, you know, well, then we'll make the best of it, I guess, and get on with it. It's not life isn't suffering, but life contains suffering. There's suffering within the human life, but it's not inherent or it's part of life. It's possible to live a human life that's free of this dukkha, whatever it might be. And so just a statement that there is suffering. Some people find this a tremendous relief that when they hear Buddhism say there is suffering in this life, because they've been used to, they feel it, they know it, some people find that their people they know around them, their religious traditions around them, are always trying to deny it and trying to put a pretty face on it and kind of make life look nice and sweet. And they say, but no one wants to look at the big elephant in the room, or no one wants to say that the emperor has no clothes. Or maybe they're putting too many clothes on the poor emperor and can't really see the person for what it is. And so Buddhism has this very realistic approach where it insists that if you really want to become a mature, upright, transformed person, dignified, noble person, you have to really kind of wake up to or see clearly the suffering you have. I remember one Thai teacher that I spent time with was explaining about these Four Noble Truths. And he said that I think the example was you're like out in the hot sun, really hot day. In Thailand, it's really hot. And he wanted to ask us, what's the difference between just suffering because it's hot and suffering that understands the Four Noble Truths? And he said the difference is that the heat is a noble truth of suffering if you understand where the freedom is in experiencing that heat. If you just suffer because of the heat, with no understanding of freedom, then you're just old-fashioned, regular, boring suffering. you know, you've had a lot of it already. You know, it's kind of, after a while, it gets kind of old. And I say that because the Buddha said it's important to get disenchanted with your suffering. Isn't that a great idea? Probably most of you are not disenchanted enough with your suffering. But so I take it too as too important. But Buddhism, but to understand a suffering and see and kind of look at it directly, honestly, and see the possibility of freedom in that experience. Not because you're supposed to suffer. Like some traditions say, you know, you should really suffer a lot purify yourself of, your defilements, your sins by suffering. The more suffering, the better, to kind of really cleanse yourself. Buddhism doesn't emphasize that you should suffer, and you should suffer better or more. It says, if you suffer, if it should happen one day that you suffer, then train yourself to look at it carefully so you can begin understanding what's going on there. And if you train yourself to look at it carefully and understand there, then starts a process of becoming ennobling. And a huge part of Buddhist practice is to learn how to relax into our suffering. Not to suffer better, but to be able to open it up and break it up. Begin teasing apart the elements of it and finding how to where the freedom might be in that experience. So the first noble truth is the truth of dukkha. I like that to call dukkha conflict. That there's conflict in life, and there's a lot of conflict. And one of the key aspects of where conflict arises is when things are not happening according to what we want. When we want it to be one way, and things are, and the reality is not cooperating, then there's conflict between you and reality. Things you might want something to happen, and something different is going on, and so that's where the conflict is. It could be that is happening that you don't want to be happening, and that's a conflict. You want something different to be happening. It could be that, and that kind of covers a large territory, that what you want or don't want is different than what's actually going on. And so there's conflict. So what do we do with that disparity between what we want or don't want and what's actually happening? And someone once said, I think it was maybe Bruce Friedman, who said something like, if there's a conflict between you and reality, reality usually wins. Is that what he said? Reality is a really tough, really tough opponent. Oh, if you argue with reality, reality usually wins. That's Bruce's quote. Yogi Bruce. If you argue with reality, reality usually wins, or always wins. So if your desire is different from what's happening, you can certainly address what's happening and try to change it, and sometimes we can, it's appropriate to do that. But in terms of finding the Buddhist path, or finding the second noble truth, it's not a matter of finding what's wrong with the world and changing it. It's a matter of looking within and understanding the nature of that desire that wants things to be different than how they are. So this is a very important point. If you want to find the path of fixing something in the world, you better understand something about the world, what's needed there. Develop street smarts, do research, whatever. And that's important to do. So the path of social change, the path of, you know, something out there, has its own kind of rules or own kind of way it's done. If what you want to do is to find the path to freeing your heart, you won't find that path by changing the world. It's important to change the world. I hope you all go out and change our world. It needs us to do something. But you don't find the path by changing the world. You don't find the path to your heart by changing the world. You find the path to freeing your heart by looking in your heart or looking in your mind. And if you look there, in terms of that conflict that exists, that lack of alignment, disharmony that might exist between you and reality, then you have to look at the nature of those desires. The fact that you want something to be different, or you want things to be a certain way. And you need to look at those desires and really understand what they are. And there's a wide range of desires we can have. We can have desires which are really wonderfully appropriate to have. And even though they're wonderfully appropriate, they're still out of harmony with what's possible or what's going on. And then, if we say, well, I feel resentful because I can't get what I want, the problem is the world, and I get angry with the world. That's your choice, of course. But if you do that, then you continue living this world of conflict. If you want to be free of the conflict, or free of this suffering or stress, you have to really get to terms with how you hold your desire, your relationship to desire, to wanting. Do you believe every desire you have? Some people give a lot of authority to desire. Whether it's a desire to have something or desire to push something away. Some people, their God is their desire. Because what other higher God could there be? But what's your relationship to desire? Some people latch onto it and hold onto it. You see it with kids pretty dramatically. And what else do they have to hold on to or relate to or their desire? Some people are afraid of the desire. That's the relationship they have. Maybe they've been burned too many times in many ways. And so they pull back, or they feel it's not okay to have desires. And so their relationship is one of not honoring their desire. It's very important to look at how we relate to desire, our beliefs around desires, our relationship to it, for two reasons. One is because desires can be the primary source for this conflict that exists. And the other is, we need to have desire to walk the path to freedom. And so if you hold your desires in check, and say, I'm not okay to desire, then you probably want to apply yourself to something as ennobling as the path of liberation. So how do you hold the desire for real transformation? Or how do you hold the desire for transforming the world and helping others? It's not a matter of getting rid of all desire. It's a matter of understanding something about our relationship to desire so we know what desires are appropriate to have and what desires to let go of. To know how to, even good desires, it's also a matter of learning how to hold those desires so they don't cause more conflict. So I have a little thought experiment for you around conflict. If I tell you that I'm in opposition to someone, there's someone out there that we have some differences going on, I'm in opposition. So just kind of what comes up for you. You don't tell me at the moment, but what comes up and I hear that. And now I say, there's someone out there who I'm in wholehearted opposition with. Wholehearted opposition with. Is there a difference? What's the difference between those two ways of being in opposition? Just regular old-fashioned opposition and enter into opposition wholeheartedly. You want to offer something? Someone? I hope someone will say what I had in mind. Yes?
What I felt was a heartfelt thing where I thought the second one was much more positive, because if you know you're in wholeheartedness, either opposition or with, then there's an honesty to that, there's a recognition. Whereas if you're just in conflict with someone, it's egocentric to me when I heard it.
So someone else? All the way in the back.
I guess I felt the opposite of the last person. When you said that, I feel conflict. It felt well, kind of a normal, what I would say a normal aversion. But when you said I deeply have this conflict, or I could just feel my heart kind of crunching. It was much more intense. The desire was much stronger.
Great. Okay.
There we have a conflict.
My reaction was similar to Jeannie's in that when you said the second one, the wholehearted conflict, it made me feel like there wasn't room for anything else.
Okay. Go over here.
I keyed on the wholehearted word. Mine, I had a positive connection with it. And I felt that if it were I, that you still embraced my humanity, and the connection to that humanity left open many paths that we might walk together.
Great, thank you. So one more here, I see.
Mine was similar, where I kind of felt like the wholehearted was sort of an embracing and holding of opposition, whereas, so it kind of gave room to see it where you are and in relation, and the just opposition to me just sounded like a wall up against where you're not really willing to look at what it is you're opposed to.
Great. Okay. Thank you. So, of course, you're all right. Because it all has to do with how we use these words, and also the history we've had of the opposition and using those words. So different people have different reference points for it. But the reference point, the way I was thinking of it, was more like how the positive side of it, that in my mind, when you're wholehearted, that... you know, theoretically, at least, my feeling is that you're not divided in the sense of the way that greed or ego would divide you. And when you're wholehearted, something else is going on besides, there's no room, in a sense, in wholeheartedness with being self-centered. And so you enter into it, into the opposition or the conflict, with something else happening besides the conflict itself. The wholeheartedness is a player in it. And the wholeheartedness is a feeling that the conflict, the opposition, is not the key thing that's happening, but rather what's maybe more important is this wholeness that's there. And what is it? How do we enter into it with a sense of wholeness, or open-heartedness, or heartfeltness in the situation? That is like a third party in the conflict. Does that make some sense? What I'm saying? Maybe not so much. So some people it does, some people it doesn't. So the second noble truth is the truth that thirst, clinging or grasping, craving, is the source or the condition for conflict. So it's not the only source. But if you want to find the path to freeing your heart, that's the source, the origin, the condition that you have to really look at in a deep way. And another way that I like to think of it is that what is the way in which desire, craving, hungering for something prevents us from being wholehearted, prevents the heart from being open, transparent, full, relaxed. And if the desire you have allows those qualities of wholeness or fullness or openness, relaxation, perhaps you're holding it just the right way. Because if you hold it that way, then you probably don't have to act on it. But if you have to act on it, then you're actually driven. And I love the English term driven or drivenness as one of the translations of this tanha, or of craving or thirsting, that defines a second noble truth. That if we're driven, we're going to be in conflict. If we're driven, we're going to end up being stressed. If we're driven, we're going to end up feeling somehow some suffering in that very drivenness. And then we know there's lots of examples of people who are driven, who drive the expression in English, I think it's expression, right? You drive yourself to the grave, being so driven. So now in the Buddhist definition of the Second Noble Truth, there's an interesting term or expression which is almost never talked about in discussions about the Second Noble Truth. People like me, usually just stop right there. Say, the Second Noble Truth is a truth of how craving or thirsting or desire in a certain kind of way gives rise to dukkha, gives rise to conflict. But there's an interesting, a little bit more. It is craving. So the Buddha defines, and what is the noble truth of the origin of suffering? It is craving. Because that's the common, what's commonly taught. That is accompanied by delight and lust. And delights in this and that. Isn't that interesting? It's desire, craving, that's accompanied by delight and lust. And what I find interesting about that is that not always, of course, but a very powerful fuel for desire is lust and in the sense of delight, imaginary delight, anticipatory delight, or actual delight that comes with it. That craving is not only something that is unpleasant, but it has sometimes within it the promise of pleasure, or sometimes has pleasure as part and parcel of it. I've known people who have been involved in, like on meditation retreats, they get caught up in fantasy. They spend hours, days, and meditating, trying to meditate, but really involved in fantasy. It can be sexual fantasy, for example, or all kinds of fantasies. But they're positive fantasies in the sense that they're fantasizing something pleasant. And the hook that keeps them engaged and involved is the pleasure they get from the fantasy. There's fantasies aggrandizement, how wonderful I am. And, building up this huge, wonderful, imaginary persona. And it might just be the pleasure of that. And then what's interesting on retreat is when people do it for such a long time, get really good at it, after, sooner or later, you see what the cost is of that kind of thinking, and you realize how stressful it is, or how exhausting or tiring it is to have the mind constantly gnawing at this pleasure, at this kind of fantasy and going after it. And after a while, people say, enough. But sometimes it's hard to let go of it because of the pleasure that's there. So in studying desire, what's the role that pleasure or lust or delight has in how the glue that keeps us locked in to those desires that we have? So Buddhism calls us to look deeply. And the way that the Second Noble Truth is in ennobling, how it ennobles us or transforms us, is if we look deeply to understand the nature of our desire, how we desire, how desire works for us. As we do that, to begin kind of stepping back from it and not being in its grip, not being caught by it, not being pushed around by it or driven by it. When we step back enough and not driven by it or caught by it enough, then there comes a time when we can start relaxing the very desire we have. Because desire, craving, is always an activity of the mind. There's always a doing going on. And it's a doing which is part of the software of the mind, of the heart, not the hardware. And so it's possible to start to relax the tension, that activity of desiring. And as it begins, so first we step back from it and see it for what it is. Oh, there's desire. And no longer be in it, in its grip. And then we're no longer in its grip, then we can just stay present for it and it begins to soften and relax. We can relax around it. And it's quite beautiful to have an experience of craving, the whole range of it, any kind of desire at all, to actually watch it dissipate and dissolve and be left not with nothing, but be left with wholeheartedness, to be left with ease, to be left with peace, to be left with these beautiful kind of beautiful qualities of heart, to be left with happiness. So to look deeply and to relax, deeply and let go, so that the clinging, the grasping, the desire can cease. Not as a way of diminishing who we are, but enhancing who we are. To becoming what the Buddhist tradition calls a noble person, to be ennobled from that process. So there's the first truth is suffering, the second is the origin of suffering, and the third double truth is a possibility of ceasing or ending that suffering by letting go of clinging. So now there's a very interesting thing that happens. If you have let go of your clinging in some deep way, imagine sometime in your life when you were the most peaceful, most at ease, most contented, most satisfied. You were just kind of there, no particular desire for anything anymore. You were satiated, happy, contented. Gone for a wonderful walk up in the hills, had a nice lunch, nice conversation with your friend. You lay down under the oak tree, the weather was just perfect. You took a nice nap, and you woke up really refreshed from that nap. And everything was right with you, everything was right in the world for at least for the next 30 seconds. that little period of time there where you really felt that, peace and well-being, then imagine in that peaceful state, there arose this really compelling desire for what? For something. And you could, if you watch, you could feel how that compelling desire, I've got to have it now, erases that peace that you experienced. And you can see that movement. And if you see it clearly enough, you can say, wow, look at that. I'm grasping onto that desire, that wanting. And now I've lost my well-being that I had. I wouldn't say that I'm suffering exactly, but I don't feel as good as I did 30 seconds ago when I felt all this peace. When you've attained some level of peace or well-being that's quite steep and stable, it becomes a reference point for seeing very clearly what it's like to grasp and what happens. And someone who's enlightened, why the Four Noble Truths are the truths of the noble ones, is because noble ones, enlightened people, have a vantage point of peace where they see very clearly what the cost is of beginning to grasp and how that grasping dissipates the well-being and peace that they have. Does that make sense? So, and really the Buddha understood the Four Noble Truths, not theoretically, but he understood it when he became enlightened. When he saw a deep state of peace, this is the way that he could see. This was the insight that he was able to live his life by, because he had that vantage point of peace. Why would you, so you're laying there under the oak tree, quite happy and peaceful, and you have this really burning desire, you have right now, I have to know what's on television tonight. And I got to do it. Where's the closest, I guess now I was going to say a TV guide, but now it's like, where's the closest Wi-Fi connection, so some people can check on their phones or something. And now hopefully you have enough sense, wait a minute, that desire, giving up, sacrificing my peace for what's on TV tonight, knowing what it is, that's not worth it. Someone who has a profound enough peace begins questioning a lot of things, not just what's on TV, but is that worth pursuing? So the Four Noble Truths were originally designed or come up with not as a description of going from suffering to freedom, but a description of how we go from freedom back to suffering. Isn't that interesting? So as a truth of the Noble Ones, the Fourth Noble Truth is the path that Noble Ones walk. It's not a matter of following a path of training so you can be free of suffering. But if you have attained a deep state of peace, deep state of harmony, deep state of well-being, whatever this is that could be possible, then this is the way a noble one would walk. You would understand the Four Noble Truths. You understand how you lose your peace by clinging. which is the first step in the Eightfold Path. You would have an intention to live in such a way that you don't take on things that keep you in the grip of desire. You would live ethically. You would speak in ways that are in harmony with that peace. You would follow a livelihood that's in harmony with that kind of sense of well-being, that insight you have. And you would engage in your mind in ways that also relate or kind of speak to or inform by this well-being that you have. So right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration are all come out of that peace. So, the Eightfold Path, the Buddhist practice, has these two major perspectives from which it's seen. It's seen from the vantage point of suffering, going to freedom, or freedom and staying there. Peace and staying there. Peace and living a life that manifests that peace. Or training in such a way that we attain that peace. What's beautiful about the Eightfold Path, it's both. It's both a training for how to find this deep sukha, peace, happiness. And at the very same time, it's the way to manifest and express that peace in our life. Isn't that beautiful? So before and after, in some ways, become the same. So, may you all think about this. And more importantly, may you all allow it to ennoble you. May you all become ennobled. So, thank you very much.